Hi there, Jeff Watts here, and welcome to episode 7 of the 2023 series of the Agile Pubcast. This episode is all about optical illusions. So can you really believe what you're hearing right now or what you're seeing right now? Watch on or listen on to find out how optical illusions might be able to help you as an Agile professional. And we've got our latest competition winner. Cheers.
Hello, I'm Jeff Watts.
And I'm Paul Goddard.
And welcome to the Agile Pubcast, the show in which Paul and I discuss what Agile is really all about over a pint or two in the pub.
In each episode, we chat about our experiences as two Agile coaches in today's ever-changing world.
So grab yourself a drink in the bar, pull up a chair, and enjoy what people are saying is probably the best Agile pub-related podcast in the world.
Welcome to the Coach House.
Yes, it's a different Coach House.
Yes, it's a ever changing Coach House.
If I knew my films or TV shows, I could probably come up with a metaphor for that. There's probably like the TARDIS is always bigger. There's something that's always different every time or something.
Yeah. So the Trigger's broom, isn't it? It's like remember Only Fools and Horses?
Trigger's broom.
Oh, come on, Jeff. So it's one of the best jokes in Only Fools and Horses was Trigger, who's the says to Rodney, he's described me, he sweeps the streets. And he's talking about his broom. He says, yeah, they've had the same broom for like 25 years, Dave. It's only had 13 new heads and 14 new handles.
I do remember it now you say it.
Yeah. I've probably got the numbers wrong, but and he says, it's not really the same broom, though, is it? But Rodney just goes, oh, whatever, Trick. Yeah, whatever. Well, I dive.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to open up my beer with my Agile Pubcast.
Oh. Check you out.
To my Agile Pubcast pint glass.
Yes, I've got mine as well today.
And put it on my Agile Pubcast beer mat.
I've got two out of three. I've got my beer mat, but I don't need a bottle opener today. What are you drinking? What's in your bottle?
It's a Brooklyn Brewery hoppy. It's called Special Effects. It's a low alcohol hoppy lager. Quite dark. Quite like a Brooklyn Brewery. It smells nice. It smells quite summery, actually.
It's quite dark, isn't it? It's like a stout almost.
It looks it there. It's more amber here. But I'm not sure whether it smells summery or it's the fact that the sunshine is out and the daffodils are out and I can hear people mowing their lawns. It's making me feel like it's summery. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, it feels like it's starting to, it's been a long old, we're in April now, aren't we? It's been a long, wet April, but it's starting to feel a little bit more like summer.
What are you drinking then?
I've gone to my outside little bar area at home here and I've picked out a can of Iford. So Iford cider, that's just it's made down the road from me in just outside Bath. And that this is one called Rushwood. I've not had Rushwood before. I'll crack it open. I nearly spilt some on my laptop. I should have poured this before we started, but apologies. you have to wait to see what the taste is like. But
we can edit.
Yes, it's orange. Is that quite, it's quite orange.
It's really orange, isn't it?
Yeah.
That looks like Iron Brew.
It's quite a strong one as well. It's 5%, which is quite strong for me on a lunchtime on a Wednesday. But it's nice.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Nice to see you, albeit virtually. Cheers.
Cheers to all of our listeners and viewers. I hope you had a nice Easter. The Easter Bunny was very kind to me.
I like the Easter Bunny bring you?
Well, I like the fact that the Easter Bunny is not too hung up on traditions. It seems to be quite emergent, evolutionary. You might say agile, because this year instead of chocolate, I got some nice alcohol.
Oh,
some nice beers.
Did you?
Yeah.
Are they
a little bit of chocolate? Don't get me wrong. A little bit of chocolate.
But Easter related beers, or
yes, some hop cross ales.
Okay.
And a couple of others, yeah, they were nice.
Did they, I was going to say something else then, but it was, Well, did they have any like pun-based names as well?
Well, it was the one that we had on the previous episode. I got another bottle of that. The hop, I can't remember the name. Hop Cross Bunny.
Hop Cross Bun, wasn't it? Hop. It was a Hop Cross.
So, so Hoppy and Hop Cross Bun.
Mm.
About yourself, nice. You like your chocolate, don't you? I presume you had.
I do. I was disappointed on Easter Sunday that I had no Easter eggs to open.
Well, maybe you weren't a very good boy.
So I was that annoyed. I went out and I went for a run, Jeff, and then I bought an Easter egg on the way back just to completely cancel out the calories that I'd lost in said run. But I was quite surprised that most of the supermarkets actually stopped. Because, you know, I was assuming that they put a half price Easter eggs out as soon as Easter's over, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of supermarkets just take them off the shelves. They don't bother anymore.
Okay.
Apart from Sainsbury's, I found some in Sainsbury's. God bless Sainsbury's. Yeah, so every time I saw one, I bought it. So I ended up eating like four Easter eggs myself.
Okay, yeah.
So I love an Easter egg chocolate tastes different. I'm sure our viewers will back us up on this.
I think that's an illusion that you're kidding yourself with.
You think I'm telling myself that I want to believe it tastes different?
Well, I think, a bit like me with the... This is it, you know, spring summer type thing. I think my mind is playing it's a nice trick on me.
Mm.
But you know, one sense can influence another. So I've got this sight of spring summerish, and I think that translated into my nose and even my taste. So yeah, I think if you've got the idea that this is Easter and you go back and you make those associations with how nice chocolate was when you were young at Easter and so on, then I can imagine that it's the same, right? It is the same chocolate. You could have bought that in the shop a month ago and it would be the same, but it tastes different. Your mind is playing tricks on you. On that note, during Easter, my wife and I went to London for a couple of days because it was also our wedding anniversary.
Yep.
And so we palmed the kids off and we went off to London. And we actually went to something called the Twist Gallery in Oxford Street.
Right.
Now, I think it has... Well, I think that's the same with most galleries, isn't it? The what's on show changes. So this when we were there, it was a theme of optical illusions.
Okay.
And there were some classics, but there were also some quite experiential ones that were just brilliant, completely messed with your mind.
Mm.
And even though you know what's happening, you're still taken in by it.
Yeah.
It was
mesmerizing, isn't it?
It was quite.
I remember I went to when we were in New Zealand. Just going back to 2008, we went to there's a quite famous kind of like museum. I think it's still classed as a museum, but it's all based around the art of the illusion, and optical and how and particularly how filmmakers use it as well. And obviously they played big into the Lord of the Rings franchise because the depth perception that they use on camera, it's no CGI. It's just you. So Gandalf, as he stands in Bilbo's house, is just standing a lot closer to the camera than Bilbo actually was. But you just don't realize it because it's just very cleverly done. And you could film yourself in this museum like walking. It wasn't the actual Lord of the Rings set, but they simulated that kind of depth perception. You could record yourself like a big version of yourself standing next to your partner, who's very small. So yeah, it's mesmerizing even for adults as much as it is for kids as to how and why it just looks really cool.
Well, this museum had one of those. I think they're called Ames rooms. I think after the name of the person.
Okay.
Creative, I know they had this with Gandalf at one end, so he looked a lot taller because they sort of shrunk that room, but they'd messed around with lines on the floor and things. So that we had a go in that, which was pretty cool.
And they had a chair on a ramp.
A chair on a ramp,
which was, again, the camera was laid out in such a way that it made it look like you were moving. The chair was moving uphill, but in fact, it was moving downhill. So it's all again, to do with the tiles on the carpet and the angle of the camera and things like that.
Mm.
It's all very clever.
But I actually took some pictures on my phone of some of the illusions. I'm not sure if I was supposed to do that or not. But
I'm sure that
just to show the kids, like just to show the kids, you know, when we came back, I think you're all right. But I'll airdrop them and I'll share a couple of them with you here.
Okay.
And we'll try and describe them.
Okay.
I think we're just going to trust the process, listeners, that at some point this will translate to being relevant to Agile.
Okay, let's go with it. Pull on that thread. It'll be fine.
All right. So let's hold on a sec. Let's share this then. This one is called the Müller-Lyer illusion. And for the people who aren't watching YouTube and are listening to us, there are two lines, horizontal lines, one above the other. They're both the same length, but one looks bigger than the other because instead of your normal arrow cap endings, so a two-directional arrow, the arrow bits are pointing reverse, so they're pointing out.
Mm.
So the actual length looks longer because of what's on the ends of those lines, but the actual lines themselves are the same length. Now, I know that's the case, but it still looks different now.
Mm.
Do you?
Mm. Yeah.
The other one that's quite similar,
okay,
is this blue circles thing. So we've got, again, we've got a blue circle surrounded by bigger black circles,
mm-hmm.
and then the same size blue circle surrounded by small black circles.
And is it the same size? Is it really? It's not, surely.
Yeah, I'm putting the gap of my bottle opener over them both, and they are the same. I can confirm they're the same. But the fact that when it's surrounded by bigger,
yeah,
relatively bigger dots, it makes that one look smaller. And when it just plays with your brain. And then this one just messes with your eyes, I think. This diagonal lines. So are they parallel, those lines? Now they are, but because so we've got a bunch of lines going across from corner to corner in a rectangle, but they've got loads of hash marks along them going in different directions. And because the hash marks are going in different directions, it makes you think that the lines are going in different directions. We'll share these in the show notes as well if you're not watching the YouTube video, but I'm not quite sure what that one's called. Did I capture that? What it was called?
The Zollner illusion.
Zollner,
sorry, with the umlaut.
But my favorite is this one. So we've got two identical shapes.
Yes.
But they don't look identical at all.
So they're identical in area, are they?
Yeah, so in the museum, they're exactly the same. So they had a template, a plastic template that you could place over shape number two.
Yeah.
And you could use that same template and place it over shape number one, and it was exactly the same.
No, shape. Jeff, they're not the same shape. They're not. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you're wrong. You are incorrect.
It's amazing. It's to do with the curve, apparently. And because it's on top, you assume it's going to be smaller. Your brain is assuming that it's smaller. But if you moved shape one down, it would just completely, perfectly overlap shape two. And that's
it's
just
easier to see when I turn my head through 90 degrees.
Is it? Trying to do because that.
If I look at the side of those shapes and treat the right-hand side edge and treat it as if it's the top, they look closer in size.
Okay. Oh, like that.
For people that can't see me and Jeff now, we're both got our heads on at 90 degrees to the cameras.
All right.
Isn't that weird? That's weird, man.
We actually used some optical illusions. Were they optical illusions? In our we used to run like an
access. I think process. So, yeah. I think. Well, yeah, I suppose optical illusions is where I suppose you can classify them in different ways. There's things that are like hidden images. I think we call them hidden images, actually. So we are telling our students, we used to give them these pictures and say give them a clue, there's a hidden animal in this picture, or there's a, how many animals can you see? So where we kind of know the answer, we kind of know what we're expecting people to see. But I think the different, another optical illusion is where something's more unexplained, like those two shapes. It's just that your brain is tricking you in some way, shape or form. It's not so much something that's hidden. It's just that your brain is being fooled. Another one like that. The famous one, wasn't it? Was the color of the blue dress, blue or gold dress, wasn't it? Do you remember that?
Yes. Now that was
a Twitter thing, wasn't it? I think it was. And that was all to do with the angle or something that you, I still now can't explain it.
Well, no, I think there's a technicality there. I'm not sure that's an optical illusion. I think that's just people have different perceptions, because I don't think I could ever see it as the other color. And I don't think you could ever see it as another color. Whereas an optical illusion, you can actually show your brain the right answer.
Oh, I see. Okay. So there's a solution. So with your example there, of which one of those is two shapes is bigger, holding that template over it allows you to your brain to see the answer. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I found one of the hidden images ones. So okay. we would give this to the class and we would say, find the third. So there's two zebras on the picture.
Find the third zebra. Yeah, we'll find the third.
So we wouldn't say find the third zebra, because there isn't a third zebra.
Yeah, okay.
We'd say find the third. And so that is it an optical illusion? Well, it kind of is in a way, because it fools your brain, because it allows your brain to make some pretty basic assumptions.
Mm.
So we'll give it a pause if you don't want a spoiler. But we've got pictures of two zebras, and one of the zebras, the black lines that make it a zebra, are manipulated to spell out the word third, but it's quite hidden. Now your brain naturally assumes that those are just black lines on a zebra. They're not just spelling out a word, and that somewhere in this picture there is another zebra, and that is a bit of a mind trick, I suppose, rather than an optical illusion as such.
Yeah.
So how did we, I can't remember, this is a long time we did this. What was the point? Why did we do that?
So we used to use those things to, we used to use those things to kind of jolt people's brains into thinking about things differently. We used to do it on a creativity session to try and encourage people to think from a different perspective as an Agile coach, think from a different through a different lens.
Hmm.
How could your assumptions be wrong?
That's right. Challenge your assumptions. Hmm. Yeah. And that's a big part of you gotta be able to imagine a different future, right? One of my favorite experiments that I often tell people about, and I've probably told you about this many times in different ways, is around learned helplessness. The idea that it's been explained in lots of different ways with different animals. First time I was told about it was monkeys being given a banana, and as soon as they went to get the banana, they were shot with a water cannon. But I think the most famous one is dogs being given electric shocks from jumping from one side of the box to another.
Oh, really?
Basically, they were given a negative... stimulus,
yeah,
usually involving pain,
right?
That taught them not to do a certain thing, and then the conditions were changed over time. So with the monkeys, more and more monkeys were brought in. They saw the same thing, and every time one would be taken out and replaced with someone that hasn't seen that same stimulus or hasn't experienced that same stimulus, and got to the point where no monkeys had ever seen a water cannon. Or a negative response to going to get that banana, but they still wouldn't do it. They just learned that actually that's not something you should do.
Mm.
They didn't have the data or the evidence to back it up. And with the dog experiment, they eventually just got depressed, let down, and whined, even though the electric shock was stopped. So That learned helplessness, that's something I see in a lot of organizations. There's no point trying anything because the last time we tried something, it didn't work.
Yeah. And even people that have been employed that have never experienced that thing are still conditioned in that way to think, well, we just won't do that because it'll never work. Or it's
that's not the way things happen around here.
Exactly. Yeah. We all heard that before. We don't do things that way, which is bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre.
We're going back to your dress analogy. It's very, very common for different people to observe the same thing and see different things.
Hmm.
One of my favorite quotes is, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are, because we can only see through our own eyes and our own lens and our own perception and filters and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah,
from a coaching perspective, helping people adopt a different perspective, look through a different lens, and appreciate and empathize with the different lenses that other people are looking through. Like, it's not stupid that you see a yellow dress and I see a blue dress. That is what it is. How can we get a common understanding of what's going on here rather than try and work out who's right?
Yeah, just I think just in encouraging people to see all potential opportunities rather than just fixing on one. One of my favorite games I used to play with the kids that don't do this anymore was, again, just to lie in the garden and look at the sky and look at the clouds.
Oh, yeah.
And see how many, you know, what different things can you see in the clouds? What different shapes can you see in the clouds? It's the same type of thing, isn't it? Trying to extend your perception. I think what I was going to pull out was, I think also it's about patience and time. Sometimes when, you know, if we don't question our assumptions, if we assume that the organization has always done this way, that's sometimes because of that kind of organizational effect that, you know, things have always happened that way. But equally, we've never just had the time to sit and actually examine it and actually study it better, study it deeper and say, well, why is that really happening? Why are we even considering this? Why shouldn't we do these things? And what would happen if we did do that? So a lot of it is just time pressure and impatience, I think.
I agree. Yeah. We tend, and actually a lot of, I'm going to say cognitive biases, because I think there's an overlap between cognitive biases and optical illusions. I think they are the result of a lot of the shortcuts that our brains naturally make to just help us get through the day, because we can't go over analyzing everything, because most things are what they appear to be.
Yes.
And so actually all the mental energy and cognitive load in trying to overanalyze everything just doesn't make sense. And we crave efficiency. We crave normality. We crave certainty. We crave routine in many ways. And so actually seeing things that we want to see and seeing things that we expect to see serves us a significant purpose. But if we do want to change, if we do want to become unstuck, if we do want to achieve something different, then we have to be open to the idea that actually there might be a different way of seeing this. And that does, as I absolutely agree with you, that takes time. You have to find the time, create the time to just sit, think, challenge, brainstorm, look at things from different perspectives. The second thing for me on this is around, and I'm probably going to use the wrong word, but ego. Because we don't want to consider the fact that we're wrong. That's not a comfortable thought to entertain, that I might be seeing things wrong, that I might have a wrong perception. And so actually questioning, well, am I right here? Am I seeing things as they actually are? That can be quite uncomfortable, but we have to be open to the fact that we might be wrong, and that that's not a bad thing. That could be really useful for us to know, for us to be able to break that illusion.
What I was thinking there was around frustration. So there's two threads that I pulled out of there. I think sometimes my job as an agile coach is sometimes it's easy to be the external, because you can see something that people can't see, or you can see a blind spot, or you can see the thing that nobody else is talking about in the room. And you can, in some respects, you can flatten that ego by a neutral or third party. And we talked a lot about, in our classes, about powerful observations. Sometimes that's the best thing you can do as a coach, is just point out something that you've seen, not to have an opinion on it, but just to say, that's interesting. That when that happened there, and that person said something to that other person, and that project and that thing happened, that was interesting, wasn't it? So I think that's a really interesting perspective that you can add to this. And now I can't remember the second thing that it'll come back to me in a minute that I was going to add in, but it'll come back to me.
I think a pigeon just flew into my door.
Oh, the other thing I thought of it now is frustration. Sometimes, so the pigeon gave me an idea then, because you've ever been out and someone will say, you're out on a walk, and someone will say, oh, can you see that kingfisher over there? And it's like a riverside view, loads of greenery and water. Now, kingfishers might be quite, maybe a bad example, because they're quite blue in color. They stand out. But maybe you've got like a bird of prey or something like that that's in a bit of tree a long way away. And everyone else can see it, but you can't. And you're like, it's like, oh, okay, where? Okay, give me some exact directions. Point me, give me some other points of reference. I can't see this bloody kestrel in the distance. Help me out. So that can be extremely frustrating as well. And we've played games as well with optical illusions like Horse and Jockey, where it can be quite, like I say, frustrating or embarrassing if you can't solve the problem, if you can't see the solution that everyone else can.
Yeah, cognitive blind spots is an alternative, isn't it?
No, but I think it's also about I'm trying to weave this in here to what our jobs are all about. If you're trying to take people on that journey with you, you're trying to create a change in an organization. If those people can't see what you can see, it's harder to lead them in that direction. It's harder to take them with you on that journey.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And being neutral allows you to see that you're not as emotionally invested in it. And then giving people a non-judgmental observation and an opportunity to adopt a different perspective without the fear of losing face, that's a really powerful thing to be able to do. I'm not sure whether this fits into landlord logic or what's our other section? We're on our own sections now, but that overheard at the bar, that's the one.
Overheard at the bar.
But you've seen those t-shirts. I'm not as think as you drunk I am. Which is obviously a play on being drunk. But
usually written in kind of blurred, again, hard to read font on a t-shirt. I've seen those before, yeah. Yeah.
But at first glance, because you kind of join the dots between the start of the sentence and the end of the sentence, you almost at first glance read, I'm not as drunk as you think I am, even though it's not written that way. What about... So here's almost reversal of an optical illusion. So you see something as it is, but you're convinced, or you become convinced, or you convince yourself that it's not what you see. So the first thing I think of there is, you're imagining monsters under your bed or shapes in the dark or something like that, where fear is creeping in. But the other one that jumps to mind is around conforming with everybody else. You don't want to stand out. Everybody else thinks something, then I must be seeing. You doubt yourself so much. You think, well, they must be right, and I'm not.
Yes. So it's socially awkward not to object.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And our desire to fit in trumps what we think accurate. Yeah. And I'd rather be wrong with the rest of the group than right on my own.
Yeah. And we say that same thing. So I think, didn't Ken used to refer to this as I'm going to pull a quote out of this. Something like he said in one of his classes that I attended, he said, the first scrum team in an organization is something like a dead duck or dead fish. He referred to it as something which this will stand out. I can't remember. It was something to do with an animal that was in some way dead or artificial. But he said, you've got to expect that the first scrum team in your organization is going to be fighting with conformity. It has to be prepared to be different. But there's something also that I remember you put into a talk there that I've watched about being the first follower, isn't there? The idea that once the most important follower is the first person that copies the new idea, and then you get this traction, you get this this new way of thinking. It becomes more socially accepted.
Yeah, and it can just be one.
Yeah.
So Solomon Asch did some experiment. I don't know when, a long time ago. I'll say 60s or something. Long time ago, where he got a bunch of actors, and they told the people that they were experimenting on that they were looking for something else, but actually what they were really looking at was conformity.
Yeah.
So he put one line up and then three more lines. One of those three was exactly the same length as the first line. The other two were quite different. They were expecting almost 100% accuracy when they asked everybody, which of these three lines is the same length as the first. And in the control sample, they did get 99-point-something% accuracy. But in the actual study, they got a bunch of actors, I think it was seven, and they all went and said the wrong line. And so the one real person at the end had seen seven people say the wrong line.
Yeah.
And was asked their opinion. And they deliberately chose the wrong one. They convinced them, either they deliberately chose the wrong one or they convinced themselves that they must be wrong and went with the crowd. But then the next experiment, one of the actors, and this is what I found really interesting. They didn't say the right line. They said the other wrong one.
Yes.
Which gave them permission to say something else. And the accuracy rate was significantly higher. So it's that not being on your own, not being the one person standing. Yeah. You've got to have a friend, or I think they called them a partner, but someone who's willing to stand out with you, even if it's standing out in a different way. And so how can that play into our role as agile coaches?
Well,
product owners.
It can, absolutely. I'm trying to think of a concrete example, but just on a general theme, it's harder to be, you know, if all your other scrum teams in your organization are doing 2 week sprints, it's harder to be a scrum team that says we'd like to do 3 week sprints because they work better for us.
Yeah.
It's hard to stick out. It's hard to be different. I had once a situation in when I was working at Nokia where the whole technical delivery stack was .NET, but there was one team that wanted to do it in open source Java. But you know, it's hard to be that one team. It's hard to be the team that sticks out. And equally, there's, from my own personal experience, I was the one scrum master that wanted to leave the office at 5 o'clock on a Friday. It's hard to do that when all your other teams and scrum masters are working into the evening. It's hard to be different, isn't it? Even though you believe that's the right answer. It's easier to conform.
Yeah, I mean, these aren't specific examples, probably a little bit too bland and generic. But if you're in a situation where you think there's a bit too much conformity, a bit too much groupthink, but there is some latent disagreement, like people just don't feel confident enough to air a different opinion, then maybe you being the one that's wrong, putting a wrong answer out there, gives people permission to air a third way. So as a secondary byproduct of proving that actually it's not that bad to give a wrong answer. That, and also wherever possible, looking out for examples of non-conformity. And so we've got a couple of different ways of looking at it here. There's obviously not one right answer. Let's see what other answers there are. You know, Paul's thought of this and Nigel's thought of that. What do you think, Ian? That kind of thing.
I've just been doing a bit of reading about the Ash conformity experiment that you've been talking about there while you were talking. The other thing that has a bearing on it is the privacy of your answer. So if you've asked the same group to write down their answer rather than speak it out, like you say, and very much if the previous six answers have all been the same wrong answer, it's harder to publicly be wrong. To be different, I should say.
That's an interesting
one. So again, that's why, again, in a lot of retrospectives, the idea of anonymizing people's thoughts and people's feelings is easier. It's easier to, even though everyone thought that particular event in the sprint went well, it's harder then for that the last person to be asked if they think, actually, I didn't think it actually went that well. I think it could have actually been done a lot better. It's harder to say that publicly, but it might be easier to write that down.
Well, we could use that to our advantage. And if there's something that we want people to agree with, make sure the first people we ask for support are the ones that support us. But equally, if we want to increase that sense of psychological safety and not want to bully people into an opinion, then we could anonymize it. I've got an actual example of this. So I had a team coaching session, which was online. And one of the people couldn't make it. So the group wanted to record it for that other team member. So we recorded it on Zoom and shared it, password protected it and everything for confidentiality and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of it, as the coach, I thought that went really well. You know, I was amazing there. And I thought, I want to share that with a couple of people who would benefit from watching that, but I can't because, you know, we had this confidentiality agreement. But I put it to them. I said, look, I'm fully expecting you to say no, and there's no problem if you do. But is there any way that I could make you comfortable with me sharing this recording with a couple of other people? So, you know, I'll censor out all the information and, you know, anonymize it and blur your names out and all this kind of stuff. Even put emojis over your faces, whatever. But just be able to share the content. I said, I don't want you to answer now. What I'll do is ask you to send me an email saying, yes, I'm happy, or no, I'm not. And if any one of you says no, it's a no.
Yeah.
And I won't share anyone's responses with anybody because I want you all to be comfortable with this. And that's, I think that sense of, because I obviously got all this charisma. I could overly influence people to say, oh, yes, Jeff, and not feel that they could say no. I think it's quite important for a facilitator, for a coach, to not have that overbearing, you know, almost bullying facilitation.
Because the likelihood is for a particular proposal or motion, maybe that's wrong, maybe I'm incorrect here, but I was assuming there, the people that are most in support are likely, depending on the personalities, you're going to get a lot of either vehement support, will be the first voices you'll hear. Or if you've got a particular a dominant negative personality, it'll be easier then to follow the negative, even though you want, you know, maybe you want to make that change or you want to adopt that change. It's harder then to to challenge it. Yeah. So facilitators have this really difficult job to try and almost give everyone's voice an equal opportunity to, in terms of timing, of when to present information.
And that's where planning poker came from, right? Sharing your estimates at the same time so we don't influence people. And anchoring is just that wider psychological phenomenon of once you've heard the first piece of data, it's very difficult to go too far away from that.
Mm.
So if one of the benefits of, there's two schools of thought with negotiation. If you're going to go first, say something, because say something big towards what you want, because then you're anchoring them. But equally, don't go first, because then you can always see where their position is. But yeah, that sense of avoiding that over common equity, I think, is the thing. Yeah. Not equality, isn't it? It's equity of opinion.
Mm. Nice.
So that went somewhere.
Yeah, that was certainly a thread that we pulled on.
Is it an illusion, or did that feel like a good episode?
Well, I think it's probably illusion based on the Iford cider, I think, for me. It probably is illusion. I feel, and it's weird. I'm probably giving away some of my trade secrets now that maybe people think I'm sitting here drinking all day long, but it just gives you, it gives me the illusion of intelligence, I suppose.
Mm. That's the
gravitas.
Beer goggles. No, it's not beer goggles, is it? It's something else. I've got a champagne moment.
Champagne moment.
On Instagram, I saw this video of, there's a couple of places, one in Italy, one in America. There's a couple of places like this, where they've designed the street to look like the water is flowing uphill.
Ooh.
So it's similar to the Ames room in a way.
Okay.
They've built the buildings so that it looks like you're going uphill.
Okay.
Water is flowing with you, but you're not. And there were some pretty good videos of that. And obviously when you don't see the bigger picture, it kind of weirds you out. But it is a really good visual effect that can really play with your mind. You say, well, that's not right. What's going on there?
No.
But that's a good champagne moment of the week, I think.
Pub notice board.
Anything for the notice board?
The notice board, Jeff. Well, we are presenting. We are live pubcasting on the 4th of May. May the 4th be with you always. We're in Cardiff for our friends at Product Tank have asked me and Jeff to come in. And we decided to make it a live podcast edition. So if you're there, you'll get to hear all the unedited elements of what happens behind the scenes at one of these things.
And you get to meet Paul.
Get to meet me.
And I'm not going to give anything away, not even to you, but I have a surprise in store.
Oh dear.
There's going to be a competition. There's going to be some goodies to give away. Limited seats, I believe. We're not in charge of that. But if you're in anywhere near the Cardiff area on the 4th of May, around about 6 o'clock, we'll put it in the show notes so you can book a ticket if you're interested. But yeah, there'll be giveaways. There'll be selfie opportunities.
Is your surprise in some ways Star Wars related, Jeff?
I'm not going to give you any clue.
Oh, really? Okay.
But
you're going to come dressed as Admiral Akbar.
It's my normal look.
Yeah, so come and join us. I think it's 6 o'clock start in on the 4th of May in Cardiff. Have a look on meetup.com, Product Tank Cardiff, for that, and you'll find us there. That's mine. Anything else from you from the notice board you want to add?
So I'm going to try and get along to the flight levels meetup group with Klaus Leopold. Quite light flight levels. I've never really gone into a lot of the, I was going to say depth, but I'm going to say height.
Huh?
About them. So I'm going to try and get, that's 25th of April. We'll put that in the show notes. And I'm going to be at Agile Manchester on the 10th to the 12th of May. If anybody wants to come and say hi, I'll be there. sharing a share a beer with you, share a coffee with you, have a chat.
Lovely.
You're not coming, are you?
No, not in Manchester. Too far away.
Oh, actually, there's something else to the notice board. A winner, the competition. You need to announce the winner of the competition.
Well, this for our visual facilitation competition to send us your drawings. So I do have it here. We have planned this bit. So well done to Sarah Alexander. Well done, Sarah, for sending us your picture on Instagram, and we will obviously show your picture as a little insert here for people that are watching online. Well done, Sarah. As a little prize is wending its way to you.
Nice one.
Good stuff. Is that the notice board done?
That's the notice board done.
Done. Okay.
So last orders.
Last orders.
Do you want a joke?
Have you got one?
I got one. It's not very good. But
go on then.
The product owner caught us discussing an optical illusion in the Daily Scrum the other day. We told her it's not what it looks like.
Oh, it's so bad. It's good, Jeff. It's so bad. It's good. Very good.
Well, that's it. I think that all that's left is for us to say to drink and sprint responsibly.
Very good.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, my friend. Cheers, all the best.